Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Klotz coming at you live from my house. We are going to do our book club class right now, and we're reading Wisdom from the House of Healing, Transformative Encounters of a Hospital Chaplain, by Rabbi Hanan Balk. That's a great book. We're literally halfway through it. Let me read to you now Chapter 6, Creating Meaningful Relationships. Page 139, Authenticity. This is Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kutsk. If I am I, because I am I, and you are you, because you are you, then I am I, and you are you. But if I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not I, and you are not you. Page 140. I, it, and I, thou. The philosopher Martin Buber, in his book, I and Thou, suggests a profound and beautiful idea I find to be especially applicable to the chaplaincy. Martin Buber posited that the most significant elements in our lives are to be found in our relationships with others. His thought, therefore, became known as the life of dialogue. Here, in abbreviated format, to be sure, is his vision of how it works. There are two types of relationships one may have. The first, Buber designated I-it, by which he meant the way one usually relates to a thing. For the most part, when I relate to a thing, I relate to it as an object. It's a one-way relationship, characterized by shallowness, distraction, distance, lack of concern, and utilitarianism. We have such relationships not just with things, however, but with many and even most people in our lives. Person we say good morning to at work every day as he passes by us without knowing who he is or ever probing beyond that greeting. The person we work closely with for years with whom we really have no interest whatsoever, save the fact that together we get the job done, which allows us both to make a living. We bounce words off people we know every day with no real concern or interest at all for a meaningful connection in those words. Such relationships abound. Page 141. Excuse me, the second relationship that Buber designated I-thou is characterized by depth, complete engagement, mindfulness, openness, honesty, caring, authenticity, spontaneity, sharing, and reciprocity. Buber explains that an I-it relationship should not be judged as an evil relationship. In fact, I-thou relationships are so unique that very few can be maintained on an ongoing basis. Neither can they be planned in advance, or forced or mass-produced. All one can do to create I-thou relationships, according to Buber, is to remain open to the possibility of such a relationship should it occur. One would hope, at the very least, an I-thou relationship would be upheld to the greatest degree possible with our spouses, children, parents, and perhaps our closest friends. But even the most wonderful I-thou relationship is destined to turn into I-it, at least at times when the relationship is strained. Even love is dynamic, capable of illustrating a true I-thou relationship, which at times becomes I-it. Of course, if the I-it relationship becomes the consistent, dominant, or sole relationship in a marriage or in family relations, such a relationship, tragically, is not likely to endure. In only one relationship is there a possibility, according to Buber, for a sustained I-thou relationship to exist, and that is when one is in a relationship with God, who can never become an it, and is the eternal thou. In the authenticity of each human I-thou relationship, it is possible to sense the presence of the eternal thou as well. Page 142, when it becomes thou. When a chaplain enters the patient's room, the atmosphere is usually distinctly I-it. The patient's name is simply one of many on my list. I have been sent to the room. I have been given a name. I know the faith that the person practices, the reason he's in the hospital, but little else. We meet each other as strangers, two individuals, completely unconnected. During the course of a short time, we begin to get to know each other, first with small talk, humor, and family background. As we become more familiar with each other, we become more comfortable. In many cases, the depth of the relationship may cease at the I-it level. But in some, the patient may feel the relationship can be trusted, and he may share his deepest, most profound thoughts and feelings, his fear that his life may be coming to an end, his concern for his family, his lack of certainty about the life he has lived and what the future holds for him when he leaves this world. I, too, after listening with full and undivided attention to the disclosure of the patient's very soul, may choose to share with him my own feelings about the matters he has raised, feelings that I also do not regularly share with just anyone. In this meeting, a spontaneous connection of tremendous openness and sharing between persons who moments before knew nothing of each other, an I-thou relationship has been forged. We both can fully sense it, though the patient does not know the Buberian terminology to describe it. And more often than not, we can sense the presence of the eternal thou, meaning, of course, God, in the midst of our conversation as well. When we pray thereafter, the holiness that pervades the space that surrounds us is now the word over here, he writes, is palatable. I don't think he meant palatable. I think he meant the word palpable. Palatable means like, you know, tasty to the palate. I think palpable was meant, which means you could actually touch it or feel it. And therefore, I'm going to make a little notation over here that in the second edition, I'm going to have to catch that typo. It's a very easy typo because the two words look so similar, sound similar, and if you write the word palatable when you mean palpable, the computer won't pick it up, especially if you're spelling it correctly. At all events, when we pray thereafter, the holiness that pervades the space that surrounds us is now palpable. As I make ready to leave the room, it is difficult for us to part. The patient is grateful for my visit. I am equally grateful that he has received me. But the greatest feeling is for that which occurred between us, an I-thou relationship. To be sure, in many cases, we will never meet again. But like a flash of lightning on a dark night, great illumination is provided, if only briefly, an opportunity to see with the heart what could not be grasped before. Suffering from I-it, page 144. Aside from the type of relationships we have described as being a part of the chaplain-patient encounter, I often can identify such relationships as they exist within the life of the patient and his family, which must be addressed as much as his physical ailments if the patient is to truly be healed. A specific illustration of an I-it problem regarding a patient is evident in the following case. Chaplain says, "Good morning. I am Chaplain Andrew. How are you feeling today?" "Oh, not too well. I have chronic kidney disease, chronic arthritis pain, congestive heart failure, terrible asthma. I am a very sick woman, but I really just want to talk to someone. You see, Chaplain, I have been reviewing my life. I haven't accomplished anything." And she's crying. Chaplain says, "Oh, I'm sure that cannot be true. Do you have a husband and children?" "No, I never got married, and I had no children. Do you see what I mean? I'm a complete failure." Uh-oh, I put my foot in my mouth on that one. Chaplain says, "Are you from a Christian background?" "Yes. I do not attend a particular church, but I am definitely a believer." "Well, if I recall correctly, Jesus wasn't married and he had no kids. Do you think he was a failure?" "No." And she breaks out in laughter. "Well, neither are you. Okay, do you have any family?" "I have my sister and her two nieces, but they keep me at a distance." "What exactly does that mean? Do you not see them very often?" "Oh, I see them all the time. They live right next door to me. But you see, I am not a part of their world. Everything said to me is on the surface and without any depth. Don't get me wrong. They are very nice people. They drive me to all the places I need to go. They pick up my medicine for me. And they look out for me. But they do this solely out of a sense of responsibility. They do it because they are required to do it, not because they want to have a relationship with me." "How then would you say their behavior towards you makes you feel?" "Well, it makes me feel alone, unloved, and scared, like I don't have anyone who really cares about me and who will care when I am gone? This is a perfect example of a person who is longing for an I-thou encounter with her family, but who is living in the realm of I-it. Note that the conversation began with the reason for the patient's emotional distress revolving around her deteriorating physical health, but it was soon clear that the deeper pain she experienced was with regard to what she considered a non-existent relationship with the only people with whom she had any connection. Her demise, therefore, would not only mark the end of her physical existence, but also of her spiritual self, in the sense that she believed her memory would live on in the minds of no one who remained. And thus, as she began, she believed her life to be meaningless and without accomplishment. Page 146. Our conversation did not end here. I asked her if she had ever spoken to her relatives about how she felt. Maybe they were unaware that she felt so alienated and longed for an I-thou experience with her family. She responded that she had never mentioned a word about it, and she decided it would be a good idea for her to speak with them. She was sure they would be coming to visit out of their sense of duty. There was, to be sure, some risk that would be taken. It is possible the family would have no interest to develop the relationship anywhere beyond its current status, but I considered it a risk worth taking, especially if the patient believed her relatives to be kind people, with the pluses far outweighing the minuses. As I have mentioned previously, in my role as chaplain, I usually do not get the chance to see how things turn out, but I believe that I had identified the patient's emotional turmoil in this situation. Her mood, as we completed our visit, was one of happiness and hope. Top 147. Can't miss the game. I was asked to see a woman who was apparently very upset and depressed. She was very large and could hardly move. She also was breathing with great difficulty. Upon my entry, she almost immediately began to cry. When I asked her why she was crying, she responded very softly. I had to get very close to her to hear. It was necessary for me to have a very important procedure yesterday, and there was nobody from my family to be here with me before, or to wait during and to join me after the procedure. I felt frightened and alone, and I continue to feel that way now. Chaplain says, yes, I am sure. That was terribly frightening. Where was your family? I asked my husband to be here with me, but he told me he could not because he had to go to the football game. He had to go to the football game? Yes, you heard that right. The football game. As she was tearfully explaining the scenario, I was a bit confused. Wait a minute. The Bengals game wasn't yesterday. It's today, Sunday. It's on in half of the rooms here in the hospital. I don't understand. I'm not talking about today's Bengals game. It was yesterday's Notre Dame game. Oh, you must be Catholic. We are. Well, it was certainly not easy to comfort this woman upon her husband's decision to choose the football game over her need for him to be with her at this fearful time. At first, I had thought that if it was the Bengals game he attended, he would at least have been just 15 minutes from the hospital, so he could return in no time if he was needed. But the drive to South Bend, Indiana for the Notre Dame game from Cincinnati is 4 hours there, another 4 hours back, without even considering the actual time of the game. In other words, he was gone for the day. I led the patient in prayer, a prayer that her husband would give her the priority she deserves in their lives together over the Notre Dame game or any other game. If this is not an I-it relationship, and the patient undoubtedly had that feeling, if this is not an I-it relationship, then what is? My little mistake. I recommend you get a box of tissues or get some Kleenex ready. This is going to be heavy. While visiting an older man who was in hospice care and his wife, who was soon to undergo serious surgery, I engaged in what is known in chaplaincy circles as life review. And the man excitedly told me about his career as a policeman. Soon, however, he broke down into tears from recalling those good years when he could still work, when he still had a home, unlike now, where he had lost everything. I then responded, Now, did you really lose everything? I see your wonderful wife of 63 years sitting across from you. You have children and grandchildren to take pride in, including one daughter who just went to get you lunch, who I have met before, and who is incredibly devoted to you. Tell me, where did you ever get such a fantastic daughter? You're right about that. I am not worthy to have such a daughter. And he began to cry. Why are you not worthy? You're a policeman. You put yourself in harm's way to protect others, to save the lives of others. Tell me, who is more worthy than you to be blessed with such a wonderful daughter? Top page 150. A few minutes later, the daughter returned with lunch for the couple and asked me if we could speak privately. She told me about some of her emotional challenges in caring for both her parents and serving as the primary caregiver for them. She was stressed, exhausted, and she, of course, feared that neither of her parents had much time left. After conversing for a while and telling her what an outstanding job she was doing in honoring her parents, I mentioned the discussion I had with her father. Oh, by the way, in a conversation I had with your father, he told me how much he appreciates all you do for him. In fact, he went so far as to say he was not worthy to have such a great daughter as you. She looks at me as if in shock, gulps, and begins to cry. I allow her to do so for a while. Oh, I am so sorry. I thought that would make you happy, but I see it makes you sad. Would you like to tell me about it? Well, my parents wanted three children, and then I came along unexpectedly as number four. My parents, but especially my father, were not happy about the economic burden that this would put upon the family. For all of my childhood, he called me my little mistake, so much so that when I went to school to start kindergarten, the teacher called out every child's name, and each answered that he was present. Each one, that is, except for me. Because when the teacher called out my name, I did not recognize it. I had never heard it. I had only been called my little mistake. As I continued throughout school, I became a participant in all sorts of school activities. I became a cheerleader. Yet my father never attended any event of which I was a part. In a sense, I had no father. When I wanted to go to college, I was told I could not go. It was too much money. So you see, what you have told me that he said is nothing short of remarkable. I cannot believe he actually said that. Now I was in shock. Wow, it sounds like your father never said he loved you. Here she's crying. Yes, that is pretty much how it was. Well, in his own way, I think he might have just said it. This daughter was nobody's little mistake. She was, in fact, in my opinion, a heroic person. Her second child was brought to the doctor at age two when she saw something was not right. The doctor told her that her son was autistic and would probably never speak or read or do the things most children do. This young mother responded, "Not my child." She then poured out her heart and soul to teach him all she could so that he could enter school. The school had nobody to guide her or support her in her efforts. And so she developed a mentoring program to serve the entire school district of 14,000 students to assist others who would go through the same challenges so they would not have to go at it alone as she did. Scores of children and their families have benefited from the tremendous work this woman has accomplished. God bless her, and God bless the little mistakes people think they make. Dirty laundry, page 152. Of course, even an I-it relationship is a type of relationship. When a woman who was 76 fell in her bathroom and was brought to the emergency room, I entered and asked if she had any family we could contact. She answered emphatically, she had no family. For some reason, I was not convinced. You have no family? You have no children? She then responded, oh, yes, I have two sons, but I do not consider them family. We have no connection with each other whatsoever. This is not even an I-it relationship. Here, there is simply no relationship of which to speak. in my pre-chaplaincy days, as I occupied my first, please clear up a second, hold on a second. This book hits me like fire. In my pre-chaplain days, oh, I can breathe again. As I occupied my first rabbinic position in Stamford, Connecticut, I observed one of the saddest relationships ever. Though again, I doubt this case would even rise to the level of a relationship. I had gone to the cleaners, and while waiting in line, I listened as the person ahead of me asked the proprietor the following question. Hey, was my son in here this morning? Your son? Who was your son? Oh, well, I see you have a note here with his name on it that has some instructions about his clothes. Was he in today? What I observed next, I simply could not believe. After asking for a description of the customer's son, the proprietor verified that he was, in fact, at the store earlier in the morning to drop off some clothes. The father then continued, you see, my son and I had a huge fight about 10 years ago, and we have not seen or spoken to each other since. Tell me, what kind of clothes did he drop off? What kind of clothes? Yes, what kind of clothes did he bring to get cleaned? Let's see. He brought in a few suits, a few ties, some dress pants, and a bunch of white shirts. Ah, so he brought in some fancy business clothing. That's good. That's good. That means he must have a very good job. As I witnessed this scene, I was overwhelmed. Imagine a relationship between a father and his son, the essence of which was informed by dirty laundry. How sad and pathetic is that? And yet, such is the reality in many a family, that parents and children have no relationship. And what they know about each other, they find out through intermediaries. I sadly know several such families. I prayed at that moment that no such relationship should ever become the norm of any other parent and child, and certainly not in my family. Chapter 7, Bringing Joy into the Room. Page 157, a verse from Psalm 118. Hashem has made this day. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Zehayom asa ananai nagila v'nismachavo. God has made this day. Let's rejoice and be glad in it. Psalm 118, verse 24. Page 158. The greatest joy in life. The greatest joy in life, a renowned rabbi once suggested, is life itself. That was Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendelovich. Despite what I have said concerning the incredibly warm reception I encountered from patients who were in no way expecting a chaplain visit from a rabbi, I believe a certain tone had been set, reflecting joy and even humor, that turned the patient's attitude from one of consternation to an appreciation of my humanity. Once I ran into a woman in her 80s, I observed in horror that she had two broken arms. My dear lady, I commented, what has happened to you that you have broken both your arms? She responded, Rabbi, Papa always used to say, Lord, it doesn't have to get better. Please, don't let it get worse. I cannot count the number of times I have told that story, which, with the exception of a patient who is in critical condition, almost always brings about a smile and recognition that, well, yes, that is true, so long as I am alive, I can rejoice. To be sure, I do not maintain that such an approach can accompany every visit. One must quickly and carefully assess the atmosphere of the room. But considering the seriousness of the illness and the demeanor of the patients, before introducing a sense of joy and optimism into the environment. But I find in most cases, joy and humor can work wonders to break down barriers. Page 160, the meanest patient. I once had to visit an elderly congregant who was ill and bedridden. From what I understood, she was not in any mortal danger, but she was very frustrated, as anyone would be in her situation. This woman had a reputation of being very mean-spirited. The previous rabbi, Rabbi David Indich of Gulf Manor Synagogue, told me that she definitely earned her reputation, but he had a great relationship with this woman. He said the secret was to use humor with her. If it was not going well, he advised me to say something to the patient of his own crafting that would help better the situation. The day of the visit came, and sure enough, she was agitated, upset, complaining, not the typical visit where the patient is so gracious and happy to see you and to be with you. I had only been there a few minutes, and things were not getting any better. Okay, the time had come to use my secret weapon that my colleague had fashioned for this occasion, says the patient. Rabbi, I tell you, I am really not enjoying this conversation, and I don't know if you should stay here any longer. I am just very fussy right now because I'm upset. Yes, I sense that. What is it that you are upset about? What am I upset about? Are you kidding? Who knows how long I'm going to be alive? I am so scared that I'm going to die. You know, why don't you just leave? Oh, that is why you're so upset. Because you are scared you're going to die. Well, that is very understandable. Why don't we talk about that? No, let's not. I told you that you could leave. So why don't you? Okay, I will. But before I go, I just want you to know, you are not going to die. I'm not? How do you know that? How could you possibly know that? I know that because someone who used to visit you regularly told me, you are too mean to die. After a brief moment of silence, as I wondered if this was really going to work, the patient broke out in laughter. She then asked me to stay for a while, and we had a while. Honestly, the highs and lows of life are really within these pages. She then asked me to stay for a while, and we had a wonderful visit. Whenever I visit her in the future, we had a great visit as well. She always welcomed me, and she was glad to see me. When I led her funeral service sometime later, I felt like I had lost a friend, not a mean-spirited woman. What made all this happen? It all began with the introduction of some humor into the conversation, a conversation that appeared to be going nowhere, and at the time was likely to be the last I would ever have with her. I learned a great lesson from the experience with that mean patient. Those patients aren't as mean as they're cracked up to be. The same could be said about all patients, I imagine. You just have to figure out a way to get through to them. Just in case, page 163, many of my visits elicited the following response when I offered to pray for a patient. Good morning. Would you like to pray before you head into surgery? Good morning, chaplain. Rabbi, I think. You work at the Christ Hospital? You mean to tell me they have a rabbi who prays for you at the Christ Hospital? Can you imagine that? Why is it they have a rabbi who prays for you at the Christ Hospital? Well, you see, the Christ Hospital wants to make absolutely sure they have done everything possible to ensure that you will get well in both the physical and the spiritual realms. So while they believe it probably isn't so, just in case the Jewish religion, as it turns out, is the right one, they have a rabbi throw in a prayer for you to make sure all of your bases are covered. Ha! I think that's great. Take it away, Rabbi. The minister was late. Page 164. Once I entered a room just a few minutes before a woman was to be taken for surgery. The room was crowded with family. After speaking with her, I asked if she would like a prayer. She responded that she did not know what to answer. Apparently, the minister of her church was supposed to come and pray for her, but he had not yet arrived. She was unsure. Should she wait for him or let me offer a prayer instead? I told her that I could pray for her, and if a minister came later, he could pray for her as well. As many of the patients tell me when I ask if they would like a prayer, you can never have too much prayer. She agreed and was so thankful that I had been there for her when her minister, for some reason, was delayed. I told her to please tell the minister, if he did come, that since he was late, you had to use a rabbi to pray for you. The entire room broke into laughter. Then I suggested, to make it even better, she should tell him that because he was late, both she and her family members have decided to leave his church and become members of my congregation. She loved it. Page 166. Meet the family. My favorite encounters where joy came into play were when the conversations turned to the children in the family, which they often do, especially when the patients, usually adult children, are visiting. How many children do you have? Oh, well, I have one boy and one girl. Do you know that if parents have a boy and a girl, according to Jewish tradition, they have fulfilled the commandment of having children? The parents understandably look at each other with a little concern, since their tradition is not the Jewish tradition. I then explain, we know this because God himself created male and female. So that must be the ideal scenario. Congratulations, you did it. You did it.
Of course, everybody likes a winner. Since I have said this, the parents routinely gave each other a high five or say excitedly, "We did it!" Whereupon I then say, "Yes, you did it. And I have five daughters. I didn't do it. I did something else." "Five daughters? You have got to be kidding. We should be praying for you, chaplain. You are really in the minority." "In the minority? I was already in the minority with just my wife. Now it's a massacre, and you don't know the half of it. After that, I had three granddaughters to add to the five daughters. All girls and no boys at all. Wow, chaplain." Now the story used to end right there. "But families grow," says the chaplain. "Well, finally, after a 33-year wait, the Messiah was born, the long-awaited Redeemer, and we had a grandson." "Yes, and let me tell you, this thing about the Messiah walking on water, it's not so miraculous. My grandson, he can fly. His feet never touch the ground with the attention he gets from all those girls." The joy and amazement that results from this playful conversation at the outset of a visit is contagious to all in the room. They're totally caught off guard. They do not expect this. Again, this approach was especially important for me to use as a rabbi who enters the room as a stranger and not a fellow member of the faith. In allowing myself to share some humor with them, I have allowed the patient and family to see me as very much a fellow human being who is no longer an unknown entity and who has shared a part of himself with them in an unthreatening manner. Instead of being viewed as a frightening figure, the likes of which they have never met before, I have very much become a person to whom they can relate. The atmosphere is suddenly transformed, completely free of any tension, and is now open for a genuinely honest, and if the patient or family wishes, deep discussion about whatever issues might be on their minds. Whom do you work? For whom do you work? Page 169. Once I was speaking with a heart failure patient about her code status, a responsibility of the chaplains at the Christ Hospital, though not necessarily at other hospitals, in what we call an ACP, an advanced care planning conversation. Through this discussion, we review the current code status to still see if it accurately reflects the patient's wishes. Why would a patient change his mind about such a matter? Due to declining health, such a patient may believe he has lived and suffered long enough and is now ready to let go without any further heroic efforts to keep him alive. Such a decision is not at all uncommon. Alternatively, a person may have been doing terribly, but then pulled through a serious operation and now wants to change his previous DNR, do not resuscitate order, to a full code, utilizing all means to keep him alive. We then convey this decision to the nurse, the charge nurse, and HeartLink nurses who monitor the status of such patients. The patient's doctor must then be informed, and he will speak with the patient before authorizing any change in code status. Here's how one such conversation took place after a few minutes of introduction. Chaplain, your status is currently a full code, which means that you should suffer, that should you suffer a cardiac arrest or other type of life-threatening episode, they're going to do everything possible to bring you back. Is that what you still want? I don't really understand what you're talking about. Why would I want anything else? Well, you see, there are some patients, often older patients, as in your case, who, as they become increasingly ill and weakened, may decide they don't want to be revived after such an episode. They have lived a good life, and it's no longer worthwhile to pursue heroic measures to keep them going. In that case, the person's code is changed to a DNR, a do not resuscitate order. Just the other day, for example, a patient told me point blank and without any hint of emotion, he no longer wants a full code. When my heart stops, chaplain, I want nobody to resuscitate me. I believe God has given my heart just so many beats, and when he has decided to stop it, that's the end. Just let me go. I'm not in any way suggesting you should feel the same way as this patient did, but this is why I am asking you to tell us if there is any change in what you want for your code status. Chaplain, I think I understand what you are saying, and I need to ask you a question. Sure. What's your question? Can you please tell me what funeral home you work for? How could you even suggest that I not live as long as I possibly could? That was what I would call a heck of a knockout punch. And I must confess that I loved it. Dear friends, we're basically halfway through this chapter, and it's a long one. What I suggest is that we cut it short over here, because it's going to take it's going to take some time to get through the rest of it. And I've got a bunch of things to attend to. So we are in basically an hour, close to an hour. Not too bad. Hopefully you're left with some great stories, great memories, great insights into the human condition. I'm hoping you're enjoying this book as much as I am. And God willing, when we get back together next week, we'll be on page 171 for part 2 of chapter 7. It'll start with Call Superman. And you don't want to miss that. So wishing everybody a great rest of the day. Thank you so much for joining us here at Book Club Plus. God willing, we'll meet tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we continue our study of Isaiah. We're in chapter 2. So please jump on board. We're in the early part of chapter 2. We'll catch you up quickly and easily. And then, of course, Talmud on Wednesday morning at, again, 10:30. Wishing everybody a great rest of the day. God willing, we'll see you tomorrow night at 7:30 for Tanakh Tuesday. Wishing everybody all the best of a great, safe, and fully accomplished an uplifting day. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.